Pull up a chair, the stories begin. Patrick and Randy are letting you in. From the desert lights where the big names are, it's Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Welcome to Big Conversations, Little Bar, the Coachella Valley's favorite podcast, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. Get ready for another fascinating hour of meeting people who make the desert city such a spectacular place to be. Now, nestled in their corner booth perch, well lubricated and raring to chat, here's Patrick Evans and Randy Florence.
Thank you very much. We are back here at Skip Page's Little Bar in the Big Corner Booth for another edition of Big Conversations, Little Bar. I'm Patrick Evans, along with my co-host, spiritual guru, and the amazing mentalist and performer, nominated for a Desert Theater League Award, Randy Florence.
Thank you. I was too busy watching our producer. Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Hey, I want to, you know, and I know that we've talked about your nomination.
We did.
And it's for the play that you did.
We talked about it, but I did it very poorly.
But I'm impressed with how you've embraced it.
Thank you.
Because now there are billboards up with, you know, Randy Florence for your consideration. I mean, the campaign is impressive.
Does it seem a little narcissistic, though, for me to be putting those up?
No, not really. But I mean, I think the three publicists that have called me to get you on Eye on the Desert.
You know, I'm an old guy. I've really only got a short time to get this thing going, Patrick.
Three publicists. So.
How do you think Patrick got all those Emmys?
For your consideration. No, that's exciting. That's coming up. When's the awards? Do you know?
October 19th, and somebody will have to call me because it's sold out and I wasn't invited.
All right. Well, I'll FaceTime you because I'm going to be...
When you announce me as the winner,
yeah.
No matter what the envelope says?
No matter what. Yeah. And Randy Florence.
I like that. Well, thank you for bringing it up. It's been quite a thrill.
What else is going on with you?
Let's see. What else? Have any other cities slowed down their speed limits?
No, you succeeded in getting my neighborhood all screwed up.
Okay, and is everybody doing okay in Cathedral City?
No.
Yeah, it's bad. John lives not far from... They reduced the speed limits through our neighborhood. Randy has been on this... I'm explaining this to our guest, whom we will introduce momentarily.
Yeah, we should eventually get him on
the
show.
We'll get there. We'll get there. Look, he's got all day. Randy's been on a statewide quest to reduce speed limits, and he's used this as a bully pulpit, but it worked. And I got an email from the people in Cathedral City where I live that they reduced the speed limits on my street. So I feel particularly picked on.
Big conversations at Cathedral City.
Could he not have started in La Quinta?
Well, he should have started in La Quinta, for God's sakes. But people don't drive fast in La Quinta.
Nobody comes to La Quinta.
That's right. Okay. You can't get there from here.
So no, nothing else new going on. I did sign up for my next acting class.
Oh, that's
though.
Right. You're going to be in Terry Ray's
acting
class. Very excited.
And there's some local heavyweights in that class. So
drop some names.
I hope I do. Well, Sonia, is it Rivas?
Quite probably. I don't know. You were telling me.
She's one of the biggies in the area.
Okay.
She's been on quite a few of the stage productions at the Bent. Susie, who you will be seeing a little bit later here, who was a previous participant in my acting class, is going to be rejoining us again. So this is going to be done as an 8-week session to do a showcase at the end of that 8 weeks. So you get to come watch me perform again.
Oh, I can't wait.
And I'm pretty sure it's a play about suicide. So,
what's the feel good hit?
Everything else I've been in has been.
Not a play about a nasal barber.
By the way, Bruce Fessier thinks we should stop talking about my nostrils. There you go, Bruce. I did it for you.
What does he know? Come on, Bruce. It's his best feature.
Let's get to our guest.
Let's do that. Lee Mills is with us, and Lee is the executive director of the Friends of the Palm Springs Philharmonic. Did I get that correct?
Palm Springs Friends of Philharmonic.
I was so close.
Welcome. Well, it's not Karen McCulkin.
It's a mouthful.
It is.
I don't blame
Palm Springs Friends of the Philharmonic.
Without the.
Palm Springs Friends of the Philharmonic.
Yes.
Okay. Well, it's been great having you on the
show.
Thank you
so much for being here.
Bye. Thanks, guys.
We should have a rule. If we can't say the name of the organization, we don't know. No, Lee, you've been on Eye on the Desert, and I must have been getting it wrong on my TV program, too. So start there and tell people what the organization is and does.
Yeah, so we're a presenting organization. We're a nonprofit operating out here in the Valley, and we bring in major symphony orchestras from around the world and present them at the McCallum Theater. So orchestras like this coming season, we have the Chicago Symphony, we have the LA Phil with Dudamel conducting.
And this is his farewell tour because he's retiring from the LA Phil.
Yeah, he's moving to the New York Phil. So this is the last season that Dudamel will be music director of the LA Phil. So
that's a big big deal, right? Going to the New York Phil?
Yeah, it's a very big deal.
Seems like it would be.
Yeah.
It's a small little band out there.
So talk to us a little bit about how did that Chicago performance come together? What's the process that you go through to do that?
Oh, goodness. It's, I always thought that it would be a little bit like juggling, but really it's you throw a whole bunch of balls up in the air at the same time and you try to catch as many as you can on the way back down. It's a very complicated process. Usually I'm talking to people in my network. They know that I'm here. They know that we're here. There's other organizations in Southern California that present orchestras. So some orchestras go through management companies. Other orchestras do this on their own. But, you know, through our conversations, either I reach out and say, we'd love to have you here, or they reach out and say, we're planning a tour. Would you like to take this on? And then we talk about when their tour is and when the dates are. And we have a very, here in Palm, in the Valley, we present only January through March or early April.
So your window's pretty small.
Yeah, it's a very small window. And that's just because that's when a lot of our patrons are here. About half of our patrons are full-time residents and the other half are snowbirds that come down for the winter. And so we have a small window. So if they're offering something in that window, then we go to the McCallum Theater. We're a separate organization. So we have to rent the hall from them.
And so you four-wall that. The space itself.
Yep. And so we go to the McCallum Theater, and depending on what they've got on their schedule and what they're booking, like what dates are available, and of course everything's happening all at the same time, so they don't even know exactly what all of the things they're booking are. They're not finalized. They might move around. They might shift around. So we kind of juggle the dates around as much as we can and make sure it works with everybody and hope that everything lands in the right slots. And it's a long process. Like, I've already started booking orchestras for 2028.
Wow. Oh my goodness. This season we can look forward to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
Chicago Symphony Orchestra with Ricardo Muti. We've got the Minería Symphony Orchestra coming from Mexico City, and they're coming with Carlos Miguel Prieto and one of our crowd favorites, Pacho Flores, on the trumpet. Mm. They just had won a Latin Grammy in 2023 for Paquito de Rivera's Venezuelan Concerto for trumpet. So same orchestra, same conductor, same soloist, and they're coming and they're going to perform that piece as well on when they come here. We have the LA Phil coming with Dudamel conducting. Academy of St. Martin is coming with Joshua Bell playing violin and conducting the organization. Let's see, we have San Diego Symphony coming with Rafael Payari, who's always a big favorite among our audience. And we have the Dallas Symphony Orchestra with Fabio Luisi, who formerly music director of the Metropolitan Opera, like he's a very big big conductor as well.
The night of the show,
yeah.
Do you get a chance to enjoy it, or do you just take a deep breath and how's that work for you?
Yeah, there's a lot to do. Our organization is only two people, soon to be three.
And so both of them are you.
You and the other person are busy.
We're very busy. You know, the McCallum is great. They've been wonderful partners. And of course, when you rent the hall, it comes with their whole production crew and their technical crew and their staff and their ushers and all of that. So that's a big help for us. And they've always been fantastic hosts. So I do get, you know, to do some more relaxing work, but it's still work, you know, like mingling with our patrons in the hall and in the founder's room. And I do duck into the concert when I can.
Nice.
But it's always like I'm the last person into the hall and the first one out of the hall.
See, that's the part I want to do is mingle in the founder's room. Can you hook me up with that?
I can.
The McCallum Mingler.
For the right price, I can.
Oh, there you go.
All right, the founder's room.
There's a deal being worked.
We can
talk. Big conversation.
We can get the checkbook out and we can make that happen.
You have an extensive background as a conductor.
Yes.
Yourself. And you conduct the Greenville Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah, in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. I'm music director of the Greenville, South Carolina Symphony Orchestra. And before I came here, I was associate conductor of the Seattle Symphony. And before that, resident conductor of the Brazilian Symphony Orchestra in Rio de Janeiro. So, yeah.
You look very young to have done all these things.
You know, I was doing my research and I thought, okay, I'm looking at his high school picture. This can't possibly be how young he looks. And then he sits down and I'm like, no. So, I don't want to ask you how old you are, but people must tell you, you look very young for the type of work that you do.
Yeah, I do. I get that a lot.
You get that a lot? So I assume that everybody who does what you do for a living grew up in Belgrade, Montana.
Yeah. Every one of us.
Every one of you?
Belgrade, Montana, town of 6,000 people and, I don't know, probably 8,000 cows.
So you always had an audience.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I think you started playing piano at 4.
Yeah.
So actually, what was it like at home that led to this?
Yeah, it was really interesting. My parents... So I grew up in Belgrade, Montana, population 6,000. And literally there was a cow pasture like on the other side of the barbed wire fence from our backyard. So growing up, it was a lot of fun. And when I was 3, actually, my parents helped some friends move. And I always, it's funny, I always thought it was like a thank you present to my parents. They gave my parents this piano that they had. And of course, now that I've grown up and I have my own piano that I have to move, I realize it wasn't a gift.
They didn't want to get rid of it.
They were just like, we don't want to deal with this anymore.
This is a burden.
You take it.
And we give it to you.
But it was great. I was 3. I started banging around on it and asking my parents for lessons. And they actually caved in and got me lessons when I was 4.
Wow.
I shouldn't say caved in. I'm sure they did it willingly. But yeah.
Was it a musical family?
No, not particularly. I mean, my mom loves music. And she played the guitar and stuff in high school, but she didn't really play it much at home. My older brother played saxophone like in the school band, but we didn't have like a lot of music necessarily happening.
Well, in Belgrade.
Yeah. They just
the Belgrade Symphony Orchestra is they're 3 guys.
No, but it was really interesting and I just loved it. I loved playing piano. And then in school I started singing in the choirs in 4th grade and I loved that. And then of course in 5th grade you get to pick what your instrument's going to be to play in the band, and I picked trumpet.
Trumpet, okay.
Yeah, and I just kept playing all of those all the way through high school.
How many instruments can you play?
Oh, like well, or can
having a nodding acquaintance.
I would say just those 3 that I'm really proficient on. But you know, I've dabbled in some other brass instruments, French horn and trombone, and I've learned some basics of the string instruments just to be able to be a conductor because we work a lot with strings. But I wouldn't ever want to like give a recital on any of them.
Do you write music for a symphony?
I don't really write music. No, it's not been my calling yet. Who knows?
So you're taking piano lessons at 4. Your parents are getting you involved a little bit more musically. Where was the first time where you said, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life?
As a musician?
Yeah. Or if there was something else you said you were going to do for the rest of your life, I'd like to hear about that too.
Well, at first it was going to be designing roller coasters.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I... You know, when I was in high school, that game Roller Coaster Tycoon came out.
Yeah.
I'm sure many people have the same story. Like, I was like, this is my
only
calling.
Only the one from Belgrade.
This is my calling. This is what I'm supposed to do.
We've heard that a lot on the podcast. No, I've never heard that. So you wanted to design roller coasters.
Yeah, and I had researched, like, all of the firms that were out there, doing it.
And had you ridden them at that point?
Had I ridden them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had ridden roller coasters.
So you knew you liked them.
I loved them. You know, I was obsessed with trains when I was a kid. I was really obsessed with trains, like crazy amount. Like my room was all like train wallpapers and I had multiple sets of model trains in all of the sizes. And
so you felt like you were on the right track.
Sorry.
It had to be said.
We're going to have to edit that out, I think.
There's going to be like 9 conductor jokes during this episode.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm afraid.
I mean, so
I think we're all on board for that.
Please continue with your answer.
So I loved trains, and I guess roller coasters are just like really fun trains, right? So why not?
And has that continued as an adult?
Do I love trains?
Trains and roller coasters?
Yeah, I don't have train wallpaper right now, but I do love trains. I just think they're fascinating. Yeah. You know, they're fascinating. Anyway, so when you grow up in Montana, also we're in Belgrade, if you're like a reasonably smart student, the only thing you're encouraged to do is to go be an engineer. Like that's the if you're a smart kid, you go and you study engineering. And I didn't really want to go in. I think by the time I graduated, I was like kind of over it, and I didn't want to go to school anywhere close to home. So I went to school at a liberal arts college in Walla Walla, Washington, which was a big change of environment. Yeah. And because it was a liberal arts college, you couldn't just study engineering. You know, you could study physics or, you know, things that were close. And I figured I would do engineering in graduate school. And I also got scholarships to be a music major.
Right.
So I was playing in all the ensembles and also kind of doing a double major thing. And then I really loved physics, especially the first semester of physics was all like Newtonian physics, you know, like you drop the ball and it hits the ground and how fast does it go? You know, all these things that you can see and play with. And the labs were really fun. We got to smash things into other things and, you know, blow stuff up and all sorts of stuff like that. And that was really great.
Eventually you got a report card.
Well, no, yeah,
physics.
That was an A. I totally aced that, okay. That one. And then the second semester of physics, though, that's when you get into like electromagnetic fields and like all these things that you can't actually see or really do anything
right.
with.
The non-tangible physics.
Yeah, the labs turn
it's like
in
geometry.
The labs turn into like plugging a bunch of stuff into a computer and then like seeing numbers happen. And I got a D+ in that one. So I was like, okay, that's maybe physics isn't my calling. I wasn't very good at calculus, so I dropped the physics part, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do music, but I still didn't, you know, I didn't have any reference point, really, in Montana for, like, full-time professional musician as a job. Like, there weren't anybody.
Did you have friends who were doing anything similar? You were just pretty much out on your own going down this path.
Yeah.
How about teachers and stuff? Were they supportive?
In college, yeah. I mean, teachers in high school were supportive, too, but it's just that there wasn't a lot of reference, like, yeah. I meant in Montana for it. But my academic advisor, and he also taught the conducting. So in the second year of college, if you're a music major, you had to take a conducting class for one semester because it's always useful if you're a musician at some point or another. So that was a requirement as a music major, and that's where I learned how to read the full score and, like, understand the elements of conducting. And I really became, like, obsessed with it, weirdly obsessed with it. Like, I would wake up on a Saturday morning and, like, roll out of bed and over to my desk, and I'd look at a score of a Beethoven symphony, and all of a sudden it would be like 6:00 p.m. and I hadn't had breakfast or lunch or dinner, like, done anything at all with my day. I was just absorbed in it. So that was really kind of a sign, I think. And my academic advisor was fantastic. He had an endowed chair that had an expense, you know, account on it as well, every year that he could spend on whatever for his classes or his students. And so when I came back the next year, my junior year of college, I had decided to put together my own orchestra. And I asked all my peers to play in it, but, like, we didn't have some instruments. Like, we didn't have a harp player at the college. And so if I wanted to do something with a harp, he would, like, the school would pay for hiring a professional harpist to come in and play with my orchestra. And all of the professors, like, took turns playing concertos with me and some of the students as well.
Very cool.
Yeah. I mean, we did about 4 concerts a year for the last 2 years that I was in school. And I started driving to Seattle to go see the Seattle Symphony, which was the first, like, big professional orchestra I ever saw. And I remember my first concert. It was stunning. It was Shostakovich 11. And I was just, like, so moved by it. It was really...
Well, what is it about a particular piece that will move you?
Oh, today it could be anything.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many things. I think the ones that I find the most touching are ones that seem like they're telling a story. You know, they're telling some sort of journey. It's weird. I can, like, see characters in my head and, like, see the whole thing playing out and, like, the different harmonies fighting with each other, and it's there's like a whole arc that goes on.
That's
got
to help a lot as a conductor,
yeah.
Being able to see those things going on in your head.
Yeah, it does. It does.
What was was there a piece of music that you just fell in love with as a kid, like the first time you heard it?
A piece of music? I don't think so. There wasn't anything I latched onto. There was a lot
of listening to? Was there mainstream stuff that you were listening
classical
to?
Classical music is considered mainstream.
It's like stuff that I'm going to hear on AM radio. On
generally, it's pretty mainstream.
You know, it's interesting. I don't listen necessarily to classical music any more than anything else.
What do you listen to aside from?
I almost listen to it less because it's my job.
Really?
You know, it's like when I'm not working, I don't want to work.
So what do you listen to when you're not at work?
Everything. Oh my gosh, when I was in high school and even into college, I was really into big bands. Like Pat Metheny and like Buddy Rich Big Band and, you know, some smaller jazz stuff, Chet Baker, Miles Davis, things like that. You know, I loved that. Pop music, I don't know. It seems like it's, a lot of it seems quite forgettable. There's probably stuff that I would play in the radio and rock out to, but
it is quite forgettable.
It's kind of, it doesn't stick, you know, around.
It's not lasting. It's not. What are some of your favorite pieces?
Right now, I've been getting into some artists that are like pretty interesting. Rufus Du Sol, Above and Beyond. They're kind of like electronic.
EDM.
Borderline EDM. I mean, like Rufus Du Sol, they're playing actual instruments and stuff and like creating it. It's not just produced on a computer, but it's, you know, it's really, really interesting. Ben Bomer, I went and saw him at Coachella. It was fascinating because he plays everything and it's all like, and then it's sampled and looped and stuff.
And but he drew a crowd.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It was really, really incredible. So I really like what's going on in that sort of electronic music genre. I wouldn't necessarily call it all EDM, but I'm not exactly sure what it's called. I'm not a genre expert. But yeah, there's just been so many things that I've been interested in. So
when you're involved in setting up a season for, say, the Greenville Orchestra, what are the pieces that are attractive to you? What do you like to conduct?
What do I like to conduct?
Yeah.
Gosh. I hate these questions. Don't make me pick favorites.
I'm making you pick favorites. As you have children, I mean, sometimes you pick favorites.
It's always fun to conduct really big stuff. I mean, that's always a blast when you have 100 musicians on the stage and can play really loud. You know, one of my favorite pieces that I've done, and I just did it for the second time, I did it this last year in Greenville, is Amy Beach's Gaelic Symphony. And Amy Beach was a composer from the turn of the 20th century. So the very end of the 19th century into the 20th century. And she would have been around, you know, Dvorak and these composers that were in the United States around that time, very big composers in the United States. And she was self-taught because women couldn't study in the conservatory. They couldn't.
Really?
So, yeah. So not as a composer. So she self-taught just by studying, you know, like Mahler and Schumann and Strauss and Dvorak and all these great composers of her time. And she wrote a symphony. She actually wrote a lot of like songs and other sort of things for smaller formations, but she did write one big giant symphony and it is so incredible. And you can hear all of the influence of these different composers she was studying, you know, to be able to do it. But I was just thinking about it yesterday that it has so many beautiful moments in it, but then the last movement of the symphony, just the way that it builds up and the arc, as I was talking about earlier, of the movement is just so energetic. Wow. And you get to the end and it's just overwhelming. It's really cool.
Amy Beach. All right, I'm going to have to look up Amy Beach music.
You should go look up Amy Beach music.
And you get a physical reaction to some of this stuff sitting out there listening.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Totally. There's some stuff that I'll like squirm in my seat while I'm listening. In fact, I told you the first time I went to Seattle Symphony, it was with my academic advisor, took me to hear the Shostakovich. He still makes fun of me to this day because I was breathing so loudly. I was like, it's just like,
well, Shostakovich is big music.
Big music. It's very emotional. It's very, you know, your heart rate gets going and it's pretty wild.
As a novice to this music, is there a story behind most symphonies?
Most symphonies, no.
No.
But a lot of symphonies, there is a story. Yeah. Usually it'll be published in the program. If there is one or not. That's the difference. We call it in the business, we call it programmatic music versus absolute music. So if it's programmatic, there's like a story behind the composition, and otherwise there's not.
And do you care one way or the other, or are you just looking for good pieces?
I'm just looking for good pieces. And honestly, I think even in the other stuff in my head, there's still...
You're still seeing it.
There's still an emotional, you know, journey that you're going on, regardless of whether or not there's a specific like plot that the composer has thought out in their head, or if it's just representing generally like something that they're feeling.
You look very young. You have a very youthful appearance.
Thank you.
Not you.
Oh, no. You were looking this way.
sometimes I check your pulse during the...
You'll hear my watch go off. Just make sure. If my watch starts beeping.
Randy's still with us. So, I mean, you work in a business, and, you know, there are lots of prima donnas in your business, and, you know, in the music world.
I mean, that's
so
where the phrase comes from.
Yes. So, I mean...
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that.
Prima donna is the star singer of the show, the first lady
of the opera.
So when you are working with a perhaps like an orchestra that you've not worked with before, mm-hmm. and there are older music, like, does your youthful countenance, do they look at you like, oh, who's this kid? And you know, is he going to be able to control this orchestra?
Yeah, that has happened. It happens less frequently now, but, you know, like 15 years ago, it happened a lot. So,
well, because you were 12.
When his mom had to keep driving him up.
When his tuxedo had shorts. This, that must have been a challenge, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah, it was. It was a challenge. And, you know, sometimes, most of the time, musicians are totally professional and they don't. But even when they're, you know, even when they're not doing any shenanigans, there's still like a little bit of like, oh, does this guy really know what he's saying or doing? But I did. I was working with an orchestra at the Opera House in Venice, actually, La Fenice. I was assistant conductor for all three of the Mozart da Ponte operas. So three operas that they were putting together at the same time. And because it was such a busy schedule, the music director for the project wasn't available to do all the things, you know, at all the times, because there'd be simultaneous rehearsals going on. And I was rehearsing the orchestra for The Marriage of Figaro. And there was a moment in the rehearsal where I kept hearing the basses, kept playing this stuff that was not in this part, and it was kind of obnoxious. And I looked over the bass. I stopped and I was like, "Basses, I don't understand what you're doing." And they were like, "Oh, we were just goofing around." Like they actually said that.
Oh, nice.
And I didn't freak out at them or anything. But I think there was an element sometimes of like,
let's see what we can get away with.
Let's see if he notices this. Let's see if he blows up when he hears it. You know, like they're kind of measuring, you know, what your demeanor is, you know. First of all, if you notice, second of all, like, how are you going to respond when you do notice? Are you going to like make a scene, or are you just going to mention it? Or
usually it's the violas that cause the problems. I'm surprised about
those bastards.
Well, you know, there's a great joke in classical music. What's the difference between a violin and a viola? A viola burns longer. Violists will get that joke. You get that joke. Come on, that's a funny joke.
There are a lot of viola jokes. I don't know why.
I don't know why violas get such hate.
They're the butt of all of the jokes. I don't know why.
I just learned something new.
Yep.
Viola jokes.
Viola jokes. It's
yeah. So we've all seen videos of conductors not happy, kind of blowing up in front of an orchestra.
We have?
Have we?
Well, I certainly have.
Okay.
What is your algorithm on YouTube that you get to see these things?
I type in conductors
angry
blowing
conductors?
Up.
Angry
okay. conductors, yeah. I was trying to make a video game out of it. But
they were all Toscanini,
so,
by the way.
So what do you do with your orchestra when it's just not going the way you want it to go?
You know, I think that's all of those videos, I would guess, are older.
Yes.
There's there used to be very much this attitude of the conductor as the supreme dictator, and like if you piss him off, then you're, and it is him. I'm saying, like, there didn't used to be women conductors.
Right.
And
right.
It was very much a dictatorship, and, you know, conductors would snap and fire people left and right and yell at people and throw stuff at people, and, you know, it was really abusive. I don't think that doesn't exist That's not the world anymore.
All those old guys got chased out of the business.
Yeah.
They're out.
They're good.
And too many orchestras have human resource departments. And,
that's a really good point, too.
Damn HR.
No, but honestly, I don't think that that's the best way to get the best music out of people, right? I'm there to have fun.
Yeah.
And I think that people make the best music when they're having fun and really enjoying themselves. And that's feedback that I get a lot from musicians is how much they've enjoyed making the music, you know, or, you know, oh, I've had people play, you know, I've had musicians come up and be like, I've played this piece 37 times and I used to get so bored of doing it, but like, I actually had so much fun this time. Mm. Thank you. You know, I think that really people do their best work when they're reconnected to that passion. And it's so easy to get into the rut and be jaded. And, you know, once you become a professional musician, it's quite a ringer that you have to go through to even build a career as a professional musician. And I think a lot of people, by the time they get there, and then they've been there, and there's union fights, and there's whatever, and you're not getting paid enough, and all these things come in to play. You know, it kind of loses that luster that people had for it when they were younger.
Yeah.
And so I always like to try to create an environment that's playful, that's fun, that's engaging. And, you know, you'd be surprised, you know, taking on a collaborative attitude. Like you mentioned earlier, when I'm just this young, you know, person in front of these musicians that have already been playing this piece for longer than I've been alive, they probably know something about it I don't. You know, they probably have, some of them, like, are super nerds, and they've actually studied this composer or this piece, and they're a specialist on, you know, Mozart Boeings or, you know, whatever. And I can actually learn something from them, you know. So I like to go into rehearsal sort of with the architecture that I want, the story that I want to tell, you know, the key moments that I want to hit in the piece, but really leaving the slate pretty open for everybody to bring their own elements into it. So sometimes you discover something that you're like, oh, I didn't know this could sound like that. That's amazing. Or let's try this. Or, you know, I like to be really collaborative with the musicians. So I don't usually have a lot of problems with that. But sometimes you get people that are just having a bad day or whatever. Yeah. And you ask for something and they're like, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, it just...
You know, singers and actors will sometimes talk about people that they modeled that were kind of idols of theirs growing up. Anybody on the conductor side that you've taken anything from?
Oh, I've probably taken a little bit from a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who were some of your favorites?
Some of my favorite conductors. I really loved Claudio Abbado when I was starting. He's this Italian conductor. Come to realize, you know, he was more of the on the asshole side of the spectrum, though, to work with. But his videos of him conducting are really just gorgeous in the way that he would allow the orchestra to play. You know, he wasn't always having a tight grip on everything. And I think his recordings are fantastic. You know, very, very incredible. There's like a tendency sometimes, you know, I feel like some conductors either try to control too much and some conductors don't control enough. There's something in the middle, you know, where the music's very free and people bring a lot to it. And I think he conducts very much in that vein. I absolutely love his recordings. And then, gosh, there's been so many conductors in the modern day that I've observed and learned from. You know, Maren Alsop was a big mentor of mine, and the way she approaches music has been just really incredible for me to learn from. Obviously, Gustavo Dudamel is very inspiring. I love the way that he gets his orchestra really energetic and going.
And he's very engaging with the audience, too.
He's very engaging with the audience. You know, he really understands that it's a lot more than just the music. You know, we're part of what we do is, you know, it's entertainment. Like, yeah. Yes, it's art, but it's also entertainment. And even as an art form, you know, some people, you know, love art for art's sake, but honestly, for me, if the audience isn't engaging with it, then, like, what's the point? You know, so the art is so much more powerful if you can bring people along with that, and I love how Dudamel just engages the audience and brings us along for this ride and the musicians.
You know, the few times that I've been at concerts that he's conducted, I just really like the way he interacts with the audience, and he seems to really appreciate it. There's a give and take there, and sometimes that's not really a conversation. Like sometimes it's very one-sided, but he seems to really appreciate the audience. And,
I think that's a crucial part of what we're doing. You know, we're not just conducting the orchestra, we're also conducting the audience. You know, we're bringing everybody into the experience.
All right. Now, I asked you if there was a piece that you particularly liked to conduct, and you said don't make you pick favorites. Opposite question, is there a piece you hate? Is there one like, I'm not going to do that on this program. I'm not going to do this on any program.
Yeah, there are some pieces that are a pain in the butt.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, such as?
I can't even think of their names or the names of the composers. They were so forgettable. It was, you know, sometimes you get these new... usually young composers that have no experience working with orchestras, and they write the music in a way that's just like impossible to put together. Sometimes it's even stuff that like you could write music that sounds exactly the same, but just depending on where you put the bars and stuff and the music would be a million times easier to conduct, but they do it in the hardest way possible. So
is
that
it like they're trying for some sort of academic exercise?
That's
versus
a good question. Yeah.
Exactly. I think sometimes it's that. I think sometimes it's very like academically, like theoretically you could do this and this and this, but they're not thinking about the practicality of actually having people make the music, you know. And so some of it's just a lack of experience, you know. I've worked with some composers where I was like, you know, if you move the bar like one note over, it will sound exactly the same, but I can actually conduct it in a way that people can follow, you know. Or I think they just don't have enough experience like observing and conducting and seeing, or they didn't talk to musicians and consult and be like, how does this work? You know, I've helped a lot of composers, younger composers, a lot of times will bring me their scores and be like, what do you think about this? And I'll sit with them and I'll go through and I'll say, you know, if you wrote it this way, it would actually be, you know, the way it's written right now, it's going to take 6 hours of rehearsal to do this piece. But if you just did it this way, we could do the same thing in 2 hours of rehearsal.
Wow.
Because it's just so much easier to read, you know. So those are usually the ones that I hate conducting, are the ones that just somebody clearly didn't think about the practicality of making this actually happen.
It might have been more about them than the music.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, today... everything with computers, you know, they
yeah,
can put
so
all
how
the notes
technology.
They can put all the notes in the computer and the computer will play it perfectly every time with MIDI. You know, it's just like, oh, it sounds great. But they don't think about how a human's gonna sit down and interpret what's on the page and represent that, you know. So
I'm sure it's happened, but have we heard an AI symphony performance yet?
I have not, but I'm sure they're out there.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be hard. We could probably do it right now if you want. Like, let's ask ChatGPT to write a symphony for us.
I wouldn't want to hear it.
I mean, no, like, I don't think I would either.
No, the experience, I mean, I love going to, you know, just going to the Hollywood Bowl or going to the McCallum and seeing an orchestra. And I mean, watching people perform the music to me is really fascinating.
Yeah, I think we're pretty AI-proof in our industry right now. I think probably composers might use it sometimes to come up with ideas, but I don't think it's going to be a final product. I mean, anybody who's used AI, you know, you can, like, I use AI sometimes when I need to do something for publishing or something, but I need ideas, and then, you know, I'll put it in, try to get an outline and stuff, but you can't really get a, or at least not yet, get a final product out of AI. Like, you couldn't get a script for one of your shows out of AI that would sound, like, really engaging.
No.
There's something about
not yet.
It that's, like, a little bit... blah still, you know, like, and when we're working in art, like symphony, like there's this element to it that makes your hair stand on end. And right now I don't think that AI is quite there yet.
No.
But especially for the performance side of it, you know.
Well, that human element is so important.
Watching like the hundreds of people on stage make music together, that adds all of that extra, you know.
So I mentioned earlier being a novice to this kind of music a little bit. What would be some of the performances you would encourage me to go see that would be the ones that would make my hair stand up?
Oh, my goodness. Everything we're performing.
Okay.
This season. Yeah. These are really great. I mean, get down to Hollywood Bowl. You know, they've got lots of great programs out there. I think today, it might be today, they're doing Rachmaninoff Piano Concertos 2 and 3 at Hollywood Bowl. If you get a chance to hear Rachmaninoff 2, like, that's been, like, science... scientifically proven somehow to be the most magnificent piece of music ever written.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, Rachmaninoff is compelling.
It's like a perfect. No, they plugged. I can't remember. It was an article that came out a couple of years ago. A study where they like monitored brainwaves and all this stuff.
Okay.
While people listen to different things of music and something about Rachmaninoff too is like orgasmic. Literally.
Wow.
Listening to it.
Well, I don't need to see the listen to those anymore.
They have
maybe
pills
20 years
to
ago.
Help you, Randy. They have stuff. That...
I can't swallow them.
All right. Obviously, the work that you're doing here with the McCallum and bringing all these wonderful symphonies, that takes up a large portion of time conducting with the Greenville Symphony Orchestra. What do you aspire to do next?
What do I aspire to do next? I just started both of these jobs last year.
Is that right? Are you that brand new?
Give me a second.
Yeah, January of 24?
Yeah, January of 24. February of 24, I started here.
Lee, the world moves fast. What do you do?
June of 24, I started in South Carolina. So, you know, like, what's next? Oh, you know.
I want you to stay here with Palm Springs Friends for a long time. But, I mean, do you have, like, is there a city or a symphony orchestra that you really... Like that's the one I really want to be at that podium.
You know, I don't know if that's what it's about for me. I've done a lot. I've conducted a lot of orchestras. You know, I've conducted the Chicago Symphony. I've conducted the LA Phil. I've conducted you know, all over the country, like from the top to the medium tier of orchestras, and it's not always like. You think like, oh my gosh, I'm going to go conduct this big giant like group one, as we call them, the biggies. I'm going to go conduct this orchestra. It's going to be fantastic. But you know, like they all have their problems and they all have their own challenges. And you know, sometimes if you get with a really amazing orchestra, especially if you're playing some traditional repertoire like Beethoven, it's actually more challenging because those musicians already know how they like the Beethoven to go. And most of the time, it takes a lot of work to get them over the hump to change something, you know. And if you get a little bit farther down in the tiering system, like Greenville, you know, a lot of times they haven't played everything all the time so much. And they're a little bit more open to suggestion, and so you can be a little more creative more easily. So they all have their own advantages and disadvantages. And I just realized, you know, right now, this is my first year being music director anywhere and not just a staff conductor that's like lower on the totem pole, like in Seattle. You know, there was a music director and then I was under, so I just had to do what I was told, right? So this is my first time being really at the helm, and I'm really excited about what's possible because of that. You know, the way that I can shape the organization and help it grow, and you know.
Was there any at the beginning, what have I gotten myself into, or did you feel pretty comfortable walking right into it?
Yeah, I felt very comfortable walking right into it. It's a really great fit for me right now, and I think that we have a lot of fun things that we can do there. You know, the whole community is fantastic, and in here as well. You know, The reason I have this job was because during the pandemic, when we couldn't perform, and then it went on for months and months and months and months, we couldn't put people in the concert hall, and I started thinking, oh my gosh, what in the world am I going to do if we can never have
a concert again?
Like, at first I was like, okay, this will last like a couple of weeks and blow over, but then it didn't, and I was like, what if we can't ever put people in a concert hall ever again? And my friend of mine, who is an executive assistant at the C-level in big companies in LA, she was like, you know, you should just get your MBA, because then it'll be easy for you to switch into, get an off-ramp into a different career, you know, because so many of your skills are transferable. It's just like people won't necessarily see it right away. But if you have your MBA, that'll get you in the door. So I got my MBA during the pandemic, and then performances started coming back. But I realized, you know, so many things about the MBA were applicable, not just to my conducting career, but also to the business side of our music. But the really fascinating thing was how applicable it was to being a conductor. You know, things...
Really?
Yeah, so much of it is about psychology and just like being a good leader and being able to get people to buy into whatever it is your vision is. And also, you know, product, like if you're doing marketing or product research or things like that, like as a conductor now, I think about like, how do I design a program that's going to be appealing to my audience? Like, what is it that these people need, and how can I build something that and help them see that that's what they need, you know. So there's a whole lot of applicable things. But then I had the MBA, even though I was starting to perform again, I was like, you know, I kind of like am tired of watching people mess up this business, and I want to run something myself from the business side. And that's how I started here. I found this opportunity and I applied for it, and I'm really excited to be here and being able to put some of my, you know, not just do the right brain and left, be able to have both of them, you know. It's kind of fun.
You spent quite a bit of time in Brazil.
Yes, 5 years.
Tell us a little bit about that. That seemed like a pretty big job.
It was a big job. It was really fun. I moved there, you know, I had finished my graduate school, and I was teaching at a university, at Towson University outside of Baltimore.
Oh, yeah, I know Towson.
Yeah. But I was just an adjunct professor, and I also didn't want to be teaching at a... I mean, I wanted to be in the professional realm and not in the academic realm. So I had been applying for all these assistant conductor jobs, and really big ones, you know, like Atlanta Symphony, the Oregon Symphony, like a lot of big jobs. And I was always making it into the final round and then not getting picked. All of a sudden, I went through a phase where I wasn't getting any auditions at all, not even invited as a finalist to audition for the job. And I didn't really understand what was going on. And I was wallowing in a pit of despair, woe is me. And I had applied for this job in Brazil and never heard back from them. And I was just like, okay, I didn't get that one either. And then a week before the audition, I had a phone call from an unknown number, and I like answered, and they're like, hello, oh, this is so-and-so from the Brazilian Symphony Orchestra. We had one of our finalists drop out of the audition, and you were our first alternate. Are you available to come to the audition next week? And I was like, yeah, sure. But I hadn't been preparing for it or anything.
And where were you at the time?
I was in Baltimore.
Okay.
Yeah, lying on the floor in my room, looking at staring at the ceiling,
Rio.
Eating Cheerios out of the box.
Yeah, and it lined up perfectly with my spring break at the university. So I was like, okay, great. So I went to Rio. I studied the music beforehand. Some of it I already knew, and then the rest I kind of crammed over that week. I had to get a visa. Like, I had to go into D.C. and get a visa, like an emergency one with no notice. Yeah, talk to the consul general there, explain what was going on. And then I went down, and when I got to Brazil, like, everything was different, because usually in an audition, I like stay up in my hotel room, like studying the score and just obsessing about everything. And I went down there and I was like, you know what? I'm already number 9 on their list. So they're not going to pick me, you know, because they have their 8 finalists and one dropped out and I was the alternate. So they're not going to pick me. I'm just going to go to the beach. And I just went to the beach, hung out, like, met people there, went to bars, you know, like just enjoyed myself, showed up for the audition. And you get to the audition and there's the orchestra, and then there's always like a table in the back of the room with like 5 or 6 people sitting there. It's like the music director and maybe the executive director and like all these other people, and they're taking notes and talking, you know, leaning over and talking to each other while you're, yeah. And it's so easy to be up there in an audition and be like, you see them like look at each other and write something down, and you're like, oh, did they want me to stop and fix that? Am I going too fast? Maybe I'm going too slow. Like, what do they want me to bring that out better? Should I stop? You know, it's so easy to get in your own head about what they're thinking about you and trying to predict like how to please them best, you know. And I just didn't care. That I was like, they're not going to pick me, so I'm not even going to pay attention to them. I'm going to do this. This is a great orchestra. Really fun music that they had picked for the audition. Some of the stuff I had never conducted before, so I was like, I'm just going to do this the way I want to do it and not worry about anything else. And I was a little bit sassy with the musicians. I was like, yeah, like at one point they were like not playing together. And first thing I do if something's like off is I'm like, okay, am I doing something wrong? No. Okay, I'm not doing something wrong. So then I just stopped and I was like, you guys play with you guys. I don't understand why it's not together. And then I started again, and it's perfectly together. You know, like I just...
They just need a little course correction.
That's right.
Yeah, or like, you know, Beethoven's 5th Symphony is on every assistant conductor audition ever. It always is. It's very difficult to start. And the orchestras know it so well that they always have their own idea of how they're going to play it. And I do it much faster than a lot of people do it. I do it at the tempo that Beethoven wrote in the score, which a lot of people think his metronome was broken. I don't subscribe to that theory. I think it was correct. So I do it, and it's pretty fast. Like, ba-ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-ba-bum. And I started it, and this always happens. You start it, and the orchestra just plays it, whatever the tempo is that they always play.
They thought, yeah.
You go, bum, 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 bum. And I just stopped and I said, no, 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 my tempo. Da, 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 da. And I remember at one of the breaks, somebody from the orchestra, and they were like, how are you so relaxed? Like,
because they've seen a lot of people up there auditioning.
And everybody's so nervous, but it was just, I just had this attitude that was like, I'm not getting the job, so I'm just going to do whatever I want. And it was amazing.
And lo and behold, you got the job.
I got the job. And I just think that that was a big lesson for me. And I carried it now. I carry it everywhere. You know, if I'm guest conducting somewhere, just don't worry about what they're thinking about what you're doing. Just do your thing.
Do your thing.
You seem very comfortable with yourself.
Yeah, that was a process. And then, I got the job in Brazil. Took a few months for all the visas and everything to get all sorted out. And then I moved to Brazil just by myself. I didn't know anybody there. It was a whole crazy experience living in Rio de Janeiro and working there. And there's something, I used to be really type A. All my ducks always were in a row and everything was very tightly controlled. And, in Brazil, it doesn't matter what contracts you have or how many emails you send or how much you try to corral everything. It's just there is a certain amount of chaos that you just have to accept is there. And I've really learned that, you have to do triage. You get to pick one thing. You can pick one thing about all of this that you can guarantee is going to be done right. And then you have to let go of everything else. Because if you try to make sure that all 100 things are done right, you just can't.
None of it will get done right.
None of it will. So you have to pick the thing that's most important and focus on that and just accept the fact that the wheels are falling off the bus all the time.
And when it's done, you get to go back to the beach.
And and also just accept the fact that it's fine. It might not feel it's still going to happen. And just because it doesn't feel completely under control, it's still fine.
And they still open every show with the girl from Ipanema at that symphony? Is that...
No, but we did perform it a lot, though, actually.
Number one request.
That's right.
But the
orchestra, they don't take requests, Randy.
No?
No, you can't just yell out.
I am a novice.
William Tell.
Beethoven's Fifth.
That free would be ride. Fun, though. We should try that sometime. That's a good idea.
You should. What would you people like to hear?
What do you want?
That would be hilarious.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll take that idea, actually.
Free ride!
So I just developed this sort of attitude of being able to prioritize things and let other things go. It's kind of surprising to me, actually, because it's so different. Brazil completely changed my personality.
Wow.
And how do you love living in Palm Springs?
I love living in Palm Springs. Yeah, this is, I loved living in Rio so much. This Rio was the first place I've ever lived that when I traveled, I wanted to go
big,
home.
That's a big, giant, bustling city, though.
It's wild. Yeah. It's 15 million people or something
like
crazy.
That.
Maybe 12. But yeah, it's huge. And there's so much going on. And I loved that. I was just go, 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 go all the time. And because of the job that I had a certain amount of clout, I guess. So it was constantly going to events at this embassy or dinner with that senator or whatever. It was really, really fun. And then I moved to Seattle, and I didn't like Seattle. It was very rainy and gray.
Yes,
it was hard, very hard. But then when I moved to Palm Springs, I was I love this place.
Do you ever sit back and think, this kid from Belgrade, Montana, a city of 6,000 people, and you were playing in front of 10,000 EDM fans in Brazil, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I do have to pinch myself. That happens a lot. Yeah. But yeah, that was a fun thing. In Brazil, I had I made friends with a guy who's a nightlife producer, and he has clubs in São Paulo and in Rio, and they produce big events all over the world, actually, London and Berlin and all over, Sydney, whatever. And they had this big party coming up, and I had told him about this idea that I have, that I still have, that I was actually working on it before the pandemic happened and kind of interrupted the whole thing. But I have this vision of putting a symphony orchestra inside a big club and using all of the club things like lasers and acrobats and video, but doing symphony music, you do the overture to Don Giovanni, but you have like acrobats like doing stuff above it, and fire and all of those things. But I had pitched this idea to him, and he was like, "Oh well, let's start small. Like, why don't you do something at this party I'm doing for our 14th anniversary of our company?" And it was like a big EDM festival on the racetrack. There were 10,000 people there. Like, the stage was like 60 meters wide. Afronissim was the principal DJ of the night, and we did Vivaldi Summer, one of the movements from Vivaldi Summer from the Four Seasons, with fireworks and lights and like all these players. You know, the soloist for the violin was like in the DJ booth, like headbanging while she was playing, and people were just like jaws on the floor. They loved it.
Was it the way you wanted it?
It was. Yeah. I think there's a lot of ways we can take classical music out of the very rigid environment that we presented in, and people will actually realize that it's cooler than they think it is.
Yeah. That might be the next step in the evolution of classical music. I really love that
idea. Let's do it at the Sphere.
Let's do it at the Sphere. Give folks the website, because I know subscriptions
are basically sold out.
But
so we have 11 seats left for the entire season.
Wow.
And they are all single seats, so you can't bring anybody with you. But it's psphil.org, psphil.org.
psphil.org.
And in any case, if you are interested in the season, you should definitely send us an email or give us a call, because we do maintain wait lists for these concerts. And people, our patrons are excellent at turning in their tickets when they can't make it. So if something comes up, maybe it's raining that day, or they're not feeling well, or like, oh, our kid's getting married and we're actually not going to be here that day, they're very good about calling us and turning their tickets in. So I would say every concert we get about between 50 and 100 tickets turned back into us we resell to our waitlist people. So if you call and get on the waitlist, we will contact you when there are tickets available.
All right, psphil.org.
Yep.
And folks can follow you. They can track you down at the Greenville, South Carolina Symphony as well.
Yeah, that's greenvillesymphony.org. So if you're going to be in South Carolina, you should check out
our
season.
And when that big orchestra rave takes place,
we were going to be all about that.
We were going to be all about it.
Oh, yeah.
Lee Mills, thank you. Delightful conversation.
Thank you. Likewise.
Very cool, Lee. Thank
you
for being here.
Really great to talk to you.
Yeah.
Thank you both.
Well, thank you for taking the time to do it. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And our appreciation to it. Randy Florence, great job.
We did it again.
Great research.
We did it again.
Phenomenal research.
It's too late. I have no idea what I wrote.
John McMullen, our producer. Thank you, sir. I'm Patrick Evans. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Big Conversations Little Bar. Please follow us and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.
Big Conversations Little Bar is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. Visit our website at www.bigconversationslittlebar.com. New episodes are released every Monday.
Big conversations, little